Welcome to the Journal of Biophilic Design podcast. Many thanks for joining us on the Journal of Biophilic Design today. We've got an amazing chap here who's done an amazing company who I think you're going to be inspired by. His name is Robert Gardner. He's co-founder of Rebalance Earth. So I mean, not only has it got a great name, but it's also got a great strapline and ethics. Enabling a world to live in, creating a nature positive economy. And obviously for me, that's the key element of biophilia. And another thing that they say on their website is where nature thrives, economies are more sustainable and communities are resilient and prosper. So Robert's going to tell us all about that. Obviously this, again, is what biophilic design does. So this is a lovely union of ideas and sort of inspiration. So first of all, Robert, thanks for joining us today.
Vanessa, well, thank you for having me on your wonderful podcast.
Lovely. Thank you. Well, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, please, what you do and what's the purpose, really, and aims and ambitions of Rebalance Earth? Thank you.
Yeah. So right now, Rebalance Earth is a fund manager. So we are raising money from pension funds. And I'll talk more about that because that's really been my background. So we're raising money from pension funds, probably the pension fund that you're invested in. Either it might be a local authority pension fund or it might be your defined contribution pension fund. They want to invest in nature to address climate change, to enable a move to a nature-based economy. And crucially, they want a financial return. So this isn't philanthropy. So we are a traditional fund manager, but instead of investing in stocks and shares like Apple and Microsoft, we're investing in nature. So our big idea is nature is the most valuable asset class, and we can come back to what it takes to do that. So that's Rebalance Earth. But my background, as I said, is I started out life as a banker working in investment banking. And then 18 years ago, I founded my first company, Reddington, which advises some of the largest pension funds in the UK. So we advised the old final salary pension schemes, the current defined contribution ones, and personal wealth, and everyone from the Aviva staff pension scheme to the Unilever pension scheme. We've advised them all, and we advise them on making sure that there's enough money to pay all of those members that are in those schemes. And so I think there's a beautiful circularity in that it's people who are saving their money today for tomorrow, and some of that money can be used to make a world worth living in. But you know, as I say, I'm not an ecologist. I don't have that background per se, although I did study geography. I'm a passionate geographer, and I'm passionate about hydrology and glaciology. And what caused me to pivot from investing billions of pounds on behalf of your listeners to give them financial security was two things, really. One, I was at COP26 and I was all into climate change and addressing that. And people started talking about nature and biodiversity and rewilding. And that statistic that we've lost 69% of all of our wildlife since 1970, it just slapped me in the face. That was a huge wake-up call. And then literally weeks later, a good friend of mine from university sent a photo to me of a glacier that I used to collect data from. I was part of what was called the Alpine Glacier Project. And that glacier has gone. And in fact, if you follow me on LinkedIn, there's a picture that I took drilling boreholes on Findlay Gletscher overlooking the Matterhorn, but that glacier is gone. And I just say that because I think glaciers are the canary in the coal mine when it comes to both climate change and also nature loss and everything that goes with that. And I suppose the good news, despite all of that bad news, and it is bad news, is I think we can turn this around and money can be a force for good. And hopefully we'll get to talk through that on this podcast.
Yeah, fantastic. And so that really, that connection to nature and that kind of drilling holes and exploring glaciers and stuff, is that really where your nature connection came from? Or did it come from an earlier age, or where was that?
Yeah, well, so I was born in Holland. So I was technically born below sea level. So I think as a small boy, I was acutely aware that you are below sea level and that you've got this engineered. I mean, obviously, I didn't know it was an engineered landscape, but I understood that I lived in this country that was at risk of flooding. My parents were both teachers, and we've lived all over the world. And as at a very early age, was taken to see the glaciers in Norway. We lived in Argentina for 4 years, got to see Iguazu Fall.
Oh, wow.
Crucially, got to see Perito Moreno, which is a very famous glacier that was still advancing. I think still is advancing in South America. And so, as a young child, I just had a passion. I think, as I say, more for geography, for travel, for seeing amazing landscapes, but also amazing cultures. And I went on to study geography at university. I loved it. And as I say, I really specialized in glaciology and hydrology, the study of glaciers and rivers. But then I went into finance. So I graduated, and then I went, I want to get paid, I want to get a job, and I want to work in finance. But there is a connection there, because I started working in foreign exchange, which is, how much does a pound buy you in dollars? How many euros does it buy you? How many yen does it buy you? And I'm a very visual person. And I see the flow of money around the world in probably the same way that I see the flow of water through our planet, through our rivers. And so I've been very lucky, I suppose, that I've got sort of 25 years of being schooled in finance and economics and business and what makes the world go round. And we live in a capitalist world. We live in a capitalist society. I don't think we're going to undo that anytime soon. And what's deeply sad is that we've depleted our nature in that 25-year time horizon. So 25 years ago, that glacier I was on wasn't meant to disappear in the next 100, 200 years. And it's gone in 25 years. And also, at the same time, you obviously get married, you have kids, and suddenly you start thinking about life beyond yourself. I'm passionate about these two topics: financial freedom in a world worth living in. I'm passionate about teaching people about money and how to use it and how to secure your financial future. But there's no point in having a good pension pot to retire on if we've got no coral reefs, if all of our rivers are filthy, we've got no fish, the air is polluted. And so that's why I talk about a world worth living in. And the exciting thing for me is, how can we turn this sort of vicious cycle that we've been on, where we have a capitalist system that creates economic growth, that creates profit and loss, that creates asset values, but has done it whilst degrading nature? I don't think that needs to be the case. And I think there's a way that we can reprogram capitalism to be nature positive, to be nature based. And actually, if we do that, I think we can actually still allow economic growth, probably not at the same crazy rate that we've had over the last 50 years, but one that is aligned with nature, and one that is alive with the people who live on this planet. And the reality is, there's 8 billion people, and we're probably going to 10 or 12 billion. So we need to find a solution to this trilemma.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, how can we do it? I mean, the investors, I mean, obviously pension funds, people are wanting to get a bang for their buck. They are going to want to make sure that their pension is worth something at the end of it. I mean, what's the key? What's the secret, the secret weapon, the secret solution that you're conceiving here? And how are people going to see the return, really? So.
Great question. So I think there's a bigger question about, degrowth, depopulation. I'm not going there. So my mindset is, with the current capitalist system, how do we work with the system and reprogram it? My personal view is, capitalism is neither good nor bad. It has some things, inputs, that drive the way it functions. And I think we can change those inputs to do that. So crucially, we have a global economy now that's worth about $100 trillion. And so that's the annual global domestic product of everything around the world. And we have this idea that we create assets. We value the home that we live in. We value the Apple or the Microsoft shares that we buy. Now, my big idea is, what if we could put a value on nature? And we know that nature provides valuable ecosystem services: the air we breathe, the water we drink, the food we eat. So we know it has value, and economists have said that the value of that is worth about $140 trillion, so almost 1.5 times global GDP. So how do we go from a world where nature isn't valued, because if it was valued, we wouldn't destroy it the way we are, to one where it is valued? And if it is valued at $140 trillion, it's bigger than all of the entire global share market, way more than Nvidia and Microsoft and everything else. It's worth more than all the property in the world. It is the most valuable asset on the planet. So the next step is, though, well, how do we get people to think of nature as an asset? What makes an asset? I think there are three things that make an asset. I like to think in Venn diagrams. So an asset typically has one or more of the following three characteristics: utility, scarcity, and cash flow. So if I buy a house, it's got utility. I can live in it or I can rent it out. Scarcity value: if I have a house that's on the south of France in Antibes, it's going to be worth a lot more than if I have a house in, you know, the middle of a town that's not particularly exciting. And then finally, can I get a cash flow from it? Well, yes, I can rent it out. I can put it on Airbnb and create a cash flow. With those three things, I can start to value a house and I can compare it depending on where it is. If I buy shares in a company, that company makes things or produces services and it creates cash flow in the form of dividends and grows in value. So the reason we buy shares is that we think that company is going to create more cash flow in the future. Actually, you know, people like to buy things. People like to buy watches. People like to buy handbags, Rolex and Chanel. Why are they worth so much? Well, they control how much they produce. And with that control in production, they create scarcity. Because a Rolex watch doesn't tell the time better than any other watch. So the utility is no different, but they've created scarcity. So we're at a really interesting point. We have depleted 70% of all of our wildlife globally. In the UK, 90% of our rivers are not in dynamic equilibrium. So less than 10% of our rivers function the way they should do. In the UK, we've lost 90% of our seagrass. We used to have 80,000 hectares of seagrass. We've now only got 8,000 hectares of seagrass. Everything that we have is at risk. So we know it's scarce. And in fact, if we lost one of our most precious resources, the humble bee, the replacement cost of that humble bee, if we lost all of them in the UK, would be about £1.8 billion to pollinate our crops that we need to live on. But we just don't, we haven't conceptualized that. And so we don't put value on it. But actually, that's what I want to do. I want to shine a light on these topics and go, look how valuable seagrass is. Look how valuable the bees are. And actually, look how valuable the whole food web and the whole ecosystem is. And these are intangible concepts, but I think we need to make the intangible tangible. But crucially, so we know it's got utility, we know there's scarcity, but at the moment, no one pays any cash flow for those ecosystem services. So why is it that we pay for Spotify and Netflix, don't pay for the services that nature provides us? It's a question that's been spinning around in my head for a while. And so I think there are five problems. There are many problems, but in order to get companies and people to pay for nature, I think we need to go to the problem, because people have tried to get people to pay for things, and we already have a mechanism. We have carbon credits. That's typically voluntary, so companies might make some kind of net zero pledge. We want to offset our carbon from our travel or from our operations and buy credits. We can talk a little bit about that. So that's one way of doing it. The second way in the UK, and I think on one of your recent podcasts, one of your guests talked about it, but the introduction of biodiversity net gain, which is where property developers have to show a net gain. And if they can't do it on site, they can then buy units where maybe a landowner elsewhere in the UK has created a biodiversity uplift. That's interesting because that's a compliance market. You have to do that. The carbon one is voluntary. But we need to come up with a way that we do this without policy. How can I get you to do this, you being a company or someone else? And I think, like any good business, a good business typically solves a problem or gives a need to a company. So what are the five key problems I think that exist for companies here in the UK? Flooding, drought, water quality, biodiversity, and carbon. And I say them in those orders because I haven't yet met a flood denier. I've met many climate deniers, but I haven't met any flood deniers.
Yeah.
Here's the crazy thing. If you live in the UK, your house is more likely to be flooded than burgled.
Yeah. Seriously.
And flood risk is only increasing. The flooding that we've seen in the last 2 years will be the least amount of flooding we've seen 10 years from now. So flooding is just going one way in the UK. In the summer, despite all the rain that we've had this winter, we're going to have droughts. We won't have enough run, enough water. Go compute. The issue is that our land, because we've degraded our nature, it doesn't store the water properly. Thirdly, we know the water quality. You can't turn on the news and not read about the water companies, talk about sewage overflows. We can't, you know, you'd never let a child or a pet swim in a river. It's filthy. It's horrible. What, you know, we need to do something about that. Biodiversity, I've already talked about the bees and carbon. We know that in a net zero world, the UK needs to suck a lot of CO2 out of the air. So even fast forward, where we've all got solar panels and onshore and offshore wind, and we've got batteries and we've got electric vehicles, we've got homes that are built and designed better, as per your listeners, the wonderful work that they do, we're still going to end up with residual carbon that we're producing. And the UK still will need to pull out 130 megatons of CO2 a year, even in a 2050 world. And I think 30 to 40% of that can come from carbon. So we've got these five problems. We know companies lose money because of flooding. Network Rail has to pay out millions of pounds for delays. If you're Sainsbury's and your supermarket floods, that's a loss of revenue. If you're a utility and you've got a hydroelectric power station and it's topping over, that's lost revenue. If you're National Grid, you've got assets that are at risk of flooding. If you're a telecoms company, you've got cables that are at risk of flooding. In the summer, all of our data centers, think about what's happening with AI. The need for data centers is going through the roof. These data centers need water. So in the summer, their big risk is the water table. And all we're going to do is use a contract, which we've used for a long time, which is called an offtake agreement. So in the renewable world, when we were trying to get solar panels and wind going, we would go to people and say, we're going to build these things. They cost a lot of money, but then they basically generate electricity for free. Will you pay us this amount of money for the next 25 years in return for that power production? And that was called a power purchasing agreement. It's basically a 25 to 30 year offtake agreement. So we're going to do the same. We're going to work with local authorities, with local businesses on a catchment level and say, hey, Vanessa, if you've got a business and you've got a factory and it's at risk of flooding, if we reduce your flood risk by 70%, we think you should pay us for that. Here's a contract. It might be a 10-year contract. It might be a 20-year contract or a 30-year contract. You might be a railway operator. You might have a whole load of homes. You might be a house builder. You might be a supermarket. Then we'll do the same for drought. Maybe you're a potato grower, or maybe you're a big buyer of potatoes and you want to de-risk the risk of drought and you want to pay for that resilience. So we'll say, well, look, we've reduced that drought risk. You need to pay us for that. So we'll end up with a portfolio of contracts, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, with transport companies, with utilities, with food and beverage companies, with supermarkets. Each one of those contracts will be paying us amount. And if you add it all up, we think we can make about an 8 to 12% return. That then gets paid back to the fund, and that gets paid back to the pension fund members. And here's the beautiful circularity. Every single person listening to this podcast is probably in a pension. The moment we start getting a cash flow, suddenly nature is an asset. And we know that when we have an asset, we look after it. People look after their home more when they own it than when they rent it. We know that when we have an asset, the rule of thumb is you should spend 1% to 2% on your flat or your home every year to keep it nice, to keep it valuable. If we don't, it depletes in value. So all of a sudden, we've changed the incentive and we've made nature valuable. And the moment it's valuable, why would you destroy it? And the moment we do that, we suddenly stop the degradation of nature, We start the protection, but even more, we start the restoration of nature, and suddenly a pool of money can flow in. And here's the exciting thing. That nature deficit that I talked about in the UK is a 50 to 100 billion pound gap. That's a scary number. It's scary, but by the way, we spend 66 billion pounds a year on defence. So it's not that scary. So that's over the next 10 years. A 2% allocation from the UK pension fund industry, which is about 5 trillion pounds, would be 100 billion pounds. So I have a dream that 10 years from now, we're back on this podcast. We say, what happened? How did the UK become a nature-based, thriving economy with people, place, and planet? Well, what happened was pension funds started putting 2% allocation to invest in nature. That allowed for the restoration of nature. Companies started paying. This is the key thing to underline. Companies started paying for those ecosystem services to reduce flood, to reduce drought, to clean our water, to increase our biodiversity, and to take capture out of the air. That then crowded in more capital, and we just created this beautiful virtuous circle. And yeah, 10 years from now, we do live in a world worth living in, or certainly a UK worth living in. And then maybe the idea spreads and other people want to copy us.
Yeah, I love this idea. I really do. When you first started talking about like nature is a value, nature is a, you know, and I know lots of people go, oh, you know, nature is us and all this kind of thing. And I feel that too. And I'm like, where are you going with this? You know, let's not, but the way you've, you know, the whole purpose is to incentivize and inspire pension funds, investors to put their money in a place and a space and an asset that will generate, well, actually mitigate actually as well, isn't it? It's mitigation of expenditure down the line. So they're actually going to be saving money, but there'll be a return on it. So I think it's really clever. And I think, well, you know, you're explaining and you're like, it's almost like a no-brainer. It's like, well, yeah, you know, and the percentages that you've just mentioned as well, that I can't remember what you said. It was like 2% or something of the pension fund. And then that would pay for it. It's like, duh, you know, we all, you know, I mean, if I think I should imagine that people who have the pension, you know, who have got pensions or who are listening to the podcast, I would assume that a lot of our, the listeners, because of their mindset, would probably put them in an ethical pension. Or, you know, trying to find those ethical pensions. But if it was me, I'd be like, I'd be making sure that my pension fund would be looking at the options such as yours to say, well, look, do you know that this exists? I was actually going to ask you before I come on to this sort of this big nature impact fund that the government's going to be doing that I know your white paper mentions. But the people who are listening, I have got interior designers, I've got architects, I've got planners, business owners, as well as landowners. Is there anything that they can do? I mean, over and above their pension fund, what can they do? You know, if they're listening to this going, well, this is such a great idea, what can they do? How can they get involved? How can they support? Can they suggest like land to kind of invest in? Or can they, I don't know, is there some kind of partnership thing or what is it? How could they get involved and sort of really help drive this forward?
Well, I think, look, firstly, to be clear, there's some wonderful pension. We're not a pension fund. We're an asset manager. So yes, the pension funds might allocate to people like us. And there are other people. We're not the only people. There are other amazing fund managers who also have the same big idea that we do. There are pension funds like the People's Pension have just allocated 15 billion pounds to climate driven investment. So not just natural capital, but how do we address this big problem? Cushion does the same. So there's some really good pension funds out there who want to do the right thing in this space. And what I would say is, if you're an employer, just check your pension, because actually the multiplier effect of your pension is huge. So part of that, I think number one, and is, let's stop building homes on floodplains. I think,
yeah,
literally a few weeks ago I went to visit a new development. It had only been built in 2021. It was like 140, 150 homes, and already 10% of those homes are unlivable in. On BBC News last week, there was a couple and their house has been flooded like seven times in the last like 10, 11 years. We know where the floodplains are. We know where the flooding is. So I think we need to join. I understand there's a need to build more homes, and there's probably huge pressure to build more homes. But let's start thinking long term. In fact, let me back up. Let's think long term. The reason why pension funds get this is they think long term. Pension funds don't think in quarters or years or 5 year political cycles. Their job is to look after your money, my daughter's money, everyone's listeners' money, and invest for decades, for 50, 100 years. Once you start thinking about that, all of these problems of climate change and nature loss are a financial risk. It's not like tree hugging or trying to save the planet. It's just common sense. This is financial, material financial risk. And we need to take that risk out of the system. So I think let's borrow that long-term mindset and so think, well, we need to do something. Of course, let's say pressure. We need to build so many thousand new homes. Let's just pause and think 10 years from now, let's ask ourselves the question, have we built these in the right place? And there's lots of amazing data. It's not that hard to like go, what's the flood risk and so forth. Second of all, let's try and sort of look at best practice. So I know in Glasgow, they're saying, well, how can we start planting more trees to reduce the flood risk? But it also captures more carbon. It just creates a nicer place to live in. It creates more shade. I know there's a very similar project in Madrid. I think, you know, we need to embrace the sustainable cities movement. So there's C40, which is the 40 most sustainable cities. I'm a magpie. Let's just copy the best ideas from around the world and bring them to the UK. And I mean, obviously, we need to tweak it and make it relevant. What works in Glasgow might not work in Plymouth, and what works in Plymouth might not work in Cambridge. But let's just take the best ideas, share them, bring them on this podcast. And it is about joined up thinking. I think the cool thing about nature is it doesn't solve one problem, it solves many problems. When we restore a river, it helps with the flooding, it helps with the drought, it helps clean the water. So we need less sewage treatment plants. It brings back the biodiversity, the salmon and the trout and the insects and the birds, and it captures carbon. So nature is 4 billion year old technology. It's probably the best technology out there. Let's embrace it. I think, look, the reality is, you know, we're 60 million people. We're going to be 70 million people in the UK. It's a kind of crowded island. So we need to be smart about how we think about our urban environment, how we think about our countryside, how we think about what we farm, and the role that nature plays into all of those, and how we can weave it in. But, you know, a big problem we have with flooding is actually in the urban environment, how quickly water runs off. So let's not have so much cement pavement. Let's have grass pavements. Let's use sustainable urban drainage. Let's build ponds into our urban environments. We know that we're going to have more heat waves in the UK. We need more. We know the cooling effect of trees. So we know all of these wonderful properties. And I'm a big believer in exemplars. Once people can see an exemplar, the Nepis State is a great exemplar. There are other ones. If Glasgow do this thing, that'll be another exemplar. Hopefully one of our first projects will be in Plymouth. Hopefully that will become an exemplar. Then people can start to go, oh, okay. Once I see it, I believe it. And now I believe it, I can get behind it, and so and we can get real traction. So yeah, that would be my encouragement to your listeners. See the cool ideas that are already happening. How do we bring it in? How can we integrate nature into our urban environment? Restore nature on the outside. And then also we need to put nature at the heart of our farming industry. One cool idea, it's not mine, but I heard from a friend of mine, Andrew Creek, is you know how towns and villages are twinned with other ones in France and Germany?
Yeah.
What if we had nature twins? So what if we, like when we built new environments in cities, we had to make sure that there was some form of nature restoration that was nearby. It has to be accessible. So it has to be visible. It has to be within 10, 15 minutes of that environment. So people can get there really easily. We can't, restoring nature is great, but it needs to be accessible to people. And we know that the bulk of people live in towns and cities. So we need to make those mesh.
I love this. I love this. This is just like pulling together everything. This is like a real full circle of everything. You know, we've been, you know, we're as sort of biophilic design nerds. you know, we're trying to always create spaces. I mean, historically, this has come from the need to create spaces better for well-being, for human well-being. But the actual original concept of biophilia was actually about the nature systems and natural systems, and about this whole innate connection to nature and being surrounded to nature constantly. And I just love how we can rationalize how we do this through the financial element as well, because we talk about the science behind biophilic design a lot. And actually our conference that we're going to have on the 12th of November at the Barbican, plug, but that's going to make sure it covers well-being, so people, the planet, but also the prosperity. And that's prosperity in every single sense of the word. Just like you're mentioning there, it's about the flourishing of the people, nature, biodiversity, but then also the economic stability of a place and people's futures as well. So I absolutely love how this is almost like, you know, it's sort of biophilic design 3.2 or something. I don't know what it is, but it's pretty cool. I do wanted to chat. Oh, so, and I did like the idea as well when you said about exemplars, and the whole, one of the reasons of doing this journal and the podcast is so that people can understand and sort of learn about best examples elsewhere to inspire people. Because I think you say, I think once we understand, once we go, oh, they're doing it, oh, I get it, oh, that's how it's worked for them, and you can learn by the mistakes, you can learn by their challenges, and I just love the magic that happens through collaboration and education and learning and sharing. So bless you, thank you for that. And nature twins, I do like that as well, so I'm gonna be making sure I push that around as well a little bit. You've got a white paper on your website, and I'm going to put a link on the podcast. It says that the government has announced it's going to invest in a new private sector blended finance impact fund for domestic nature recovery called the Big Nature Impact Fund. Can you tell us a bit more about that, please? Do you know what that's going to look like, and what the difference it's going to make? Where's the money going to go? Can you maybe explain that a little bit?
That fund is another one of the funds like Rebalance Earth. So that's run by Federated Hermes and Finance Earth. And the idea, what government wanted to do was put that 30 million in to encourage other pension funds to invest, to do exactly what I described. I mean, they've got a different take on it, but it's the same big idea. So really what the government is doing is just sending a signal and saying, look, we'll put 30 million in, and it's what's called a first loss piece. So any losses on that will be absorbed by government. So really it's making it super safe for any pension fund who invests to come in. And I think, you know, DEFRA have said that by 2030, they want £1 billion a year to be coming from the private sector to do this. So they very much understand this sort of 50 to £100 billion nature deficit cannot be closed by the government. And what we need is a private sector model. So this is just a great way that they're trying to kind of incentivize this. And, you know, I think the government have actually done a good job, despite all the sort of political news that sits over the top, with this, with biodiversity net gain, with the, you know, sustainable farming initiative. And I know there've been some ruffles, but I think directionally they're moving in the right way to say, how do we find a better way to work with nature? We know, you know, they've made commitments to restore 30% of life on land and life underwater by 2030 and 50% by 2050. So that was at the Montreal Coming 2015 COP, which is the biodiversity COP. So they are working in the right way, but they know they don't have enough money to do it on their own. They need to crowd in private capital, and this is just a great example of it. And as I said, we're technically competitors with Federated Hermes and Finance Earth, but I think we all win if pension funds allocate money to them and they start doing this. We all benefit. We all get people, planet, and prosperity. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, if landlords are listening to this, real estate owners and things like that, who are kind of going, God, you know, I've got this plot of land, how can I, you know, and they're looking for like investment or looking for that kind of thing. Is there somewhere for them to go? I mean, this is probably like a really ignorant question, but if someone is starting out on this journey, or if they're a farmer, or they've got a, you know, a big plot of land, where would they go to kind of find out about this, to kind of get funded or something?
Yeah, I think if you're big landowners and you want to in, or even if you're smaller landowners, there's typically, let's say for farmers, there's farming clusters. So increasingly people are forming farming clusters to try and organize, because actually it's about coordinate. The key thing for this to work, it needs to be done at scale. It can't be piecemeal. It needs to be a number of people acting together to do it. So actually the hardest bit, you said at the beginning, it sounds so common sense, almost sounds too easy. The hardest thing is that this is like the most complicated party game of musical chairs that we're ever going to have to do. So coordinating, aligning, incentivizing everyone to do it, you know, like at a wedding when you try and get everyone for that photo. That's we're about to do the biggest wedding photo ever, where we've got to get everyone in the right place ready for that perfect photo. So at a local level, there will probably be some farming clusters. There are a number of councils who are trying to sort of organize, you know, Plymouth City Council are really leading on this locally. And obviously I know Glasgow are working on a project. So I think educate yourself about the big schemes, but in order to attract the money from funds, CARS, the Federated Hermes one, you need to find a way to do it at scale. The other one is the Rivers Trust. Obviously, the Rivers Trust do amazing work around the country around our rivers. So I'm guessing it depends on what the theme is. But I bet you there is someone in your area who is already thinking this way and saying, well, how can we work together to attract the money from the Big Nature Fund, the Rebalance Earth Fund?
Yeah, that's really nice. It's back down to cooperation, isn't it? It's about down communication, collaboration, trust. But, you know, it's about talking and communication and cooperation. it's brilliant. One of the strap lines on the Rebalance Earth white paper, as I said, I'm going to put a link to it on the spiel that goes with the podcast. You've written here, we aim to enable the flow of private capital to protect and restore nature. Do you have an example that you can maybe share of how, you know, knowledgeably, you know, that there's been a pension fund money or investment money that's gone into a space that's actually made a difference and had a positive impact on people and planet?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is new. So I think money has already flowed into rewilding. So there's a brilliant firm called Oxygen Conservation, where they've I think raised about £100 million, and they have been buying up degraded farmland that was maybe used for grouse shooting, and they're rewilding the land. They're bringing back temperate rainforest in the UK, and so they're taking it from a model that was kind of basically degrading the land to a model that is embracing all of the things we've been talking about. And so how can the land be used to create biodiversity net gain? How can it be used to capture carbon? Can they sell those? And then on top of that, can they maybe make a bit of extra money using ecotourism? So as I say, Oxygen Conservation have done a really good job in a short space of time of raising £100 million, deploying that and doing that. Another example of that is Nattergal, that are also buying land and sort of replicating the NEP estate. And they've bought a few plots of land in the UK, and again, taking farmland and rewilding it and creating biodiversity net gain units. And then similar is also happening in Scotland with Scotland Rewilding. St. Jeremy Leggett has done some great stuff there. I think the next step, though, is how do we move? They're still relatively small. How can we do this at more scale and really unlock those bigger opportunities around tackling flood, water quality, drought? But those are really good early examples of private capital being used to protect and restore nature and create an alternative financial model to the way we've been using our land for the last 200 years.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really refreshing to know that these things are happening, and you know, the more, like you say, the more funds and the more people are actually doing this, and it's raising awareness again, isn't it? It's about knowing that this is here and it's happening, and this is the way forward, and there's a solution, and it's easy, because everybody likes like easy stuff. They don't like struggles, not unless you're crazy entrepreneur type person. Then, but you know, most corporates and business owners just, you know, want the nice plug and play. And I think the more it happens, the more people understand it. I think the scale will happen. We've just got to keep the faith and keep banging on doors and raising awareness. So we're getting near the end, but I did want to ask you, is there anything else that you'd like to add, or anything you'd like to encourage people to do, or to, you know, any sort of final words of inspiration before I ask you the final question?
Look, I think it's easy once you know the state of the planet with climate change and the nature loss, it's easy to get depressed. But I'm a big believer in agency. I think we can do things at many levels. So each one of us is each adult person listening to this is a voter. So who you vote for matters. Second of all, each one of us is a consumer. What we eat, what we wear, who we buy from, how frequently, our kind of consumption patterns individually doesn't matter, but collectively makes a massive, massive difference and sends a massive signal to those companies about what we care about. Thirdly, how we invest our money really, as I say, has a massive impact. It 27 times more impact than any of these things. So I suppose think about who you vote for, think about how you consume, think about how you invest your money. I think for us to move from the model that we're in to this new world requires awareness, which this podcast is doing a good job of, but it requires desire. You know, we need a vision of a better future than the one that we have today. It needs knowledge. How do I get from A to B? I like what you said, you know. Actually, Rebalance Earth is trying to make it plug and play, make it easy for companies to go, well, why wouldn't I do that? That sounds pretty easy. Oh, I'm a pension fund. Why wouldn't I put 2% plug and play? And then, you know, that creates ability, that creates action. And then we need to reinforce it. We tell stories, we create exemplars. We go, oh, wow, did you hear about this? We should do that. So, yeah, that's what I would say.
Yeah, no, fantastic. Really, really good. And I think... I'm excited. I'm excited to buy. So I'm going to get you on within 5 years. I might get you in beforehand to talk about rivers, but that's something else. That'll be like talking about water, 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 which we all love. So the final question that I ask everybody on the podcast, if you could paint the world with a magic brush of biophilia, what would it look like?
I love this question. And I have to say, the first time I met you, I didn't know what biophilia meant. So thank you for educating me. I'm going to twist it and say, you know, paint a world worth living in, because that's the what I want to do. And well, certainly let's start with the UK worth living in. I think when I think about the UK, there are probably three big building blocks we need to solve. The towns and cities where most of us live in, the countryside, and the way we produce food that we need to live on. On towns and cities, we need to put nature at the way that we design things. We've talked about sustainable urban drainage, we've talked about ponds, we've talked about trees, how it reduces flood risk, how it will dampen the impact of heat waves in the summer. It just creates a nicer place to live. We know the mental health benefits and the health benefits of nature. So how do we reintegrate nature into our urban planning and design and have nature-based towns and cities? Let's just copy and paste the best ideas from around the world. So that's one. I think on our countryside, we think that our countryside is a green and pleasant land. It's not. It's heavily engineered. It's, you know, let's try and restore those rivers. Let's get the beavers back. Let's get the salmon and the trout. Remove the weirs and we'll hear it. Well, the bird song will be there. We'll know when our countryside is thriving with life. Our hedgerows haven't been shaved like they're in the US Marines. There's birds and insects in our hedgerows, and there's insects on our windscreens and our number plates. And then finally, you know, how we farm matters. Farming is a crucial job for all of us to succeed. So how can we embrace agroecology, put nature into the process, take the best of what we know from 10,000 years of farming, plus the best of modern techniques, and create a resilient, sustainable farming model that first and foremost is resilient and sustainable for the farmers who do the amazing work for us every day to put food on our plate. We need to make sure that they have a sustainable income to support their families first and foremost. And if we do that, we can enable that transition. So what's not to love? We have nature-based homes, towns and cities. We have the countryside, which actually has nature back in it. And we have a farming system that has nature at the heart of it. That is my vision of a world worth living in.
Thank you for listening to the Journal of Biophilic Design podcast.